time.
I don't know, you should probably talk to my husband.
Ready? That's a transparency, I feel like.
It's probably in his, is.
House Committee on Revenue will come to order. We'll open a work session on the possible introduction of committee bills. Representative Benz.
Chair, I move introduction of, as a committee bill, LC-2903, dated 1/22/15.
Thank you very much. Representative Benz moves the introduction of Legislative Council 2903, dated 1/22/15. Discussion? The usual proviso applies. Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Close the work session. Open an information meeting on school funding, on school formula. Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have several things in the OLAs for you. One is a review of the school district formula revenue allocation. It's kind of part of our normal orientation process. And then there was also, in the interim, as you recall, a task force on school funding that was staffed by Department of Education, and they're going to go through that as well. But we also have the co-chair of that task force here, Senator Devlin, and understand that Representative Comp will come shortly, or will come later after we've had some of the information discussion.
Okay. Senator, do you want to go first, or do you want to wait for her?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I actually have to be in another one.
Then you better go first.
I thought I would do the intro. Ryan Reeder will give the details, and Representative Comp will be here to answer any questions.
that sounds like a great division of responsibility. For the record.
For the record, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. I'm going to do this a little bit more quickly than I did yesterday, because I know that you have limited time here. But I did want to talk to you just briefly about the task force on school funding. It came about as by passage of House Bill 2506 in the 2013 session. To the outside world, the term task force on school funding probably gives the wrong impression. The impression is that this was a task force looking at how to increase school funding. It's actually a task force to look at whether or not there needed to be any changes in the state school fund distribution formula, something that you will hear more details on, and many of you know pretty well, actually, about that formula. The last time, since the formula was put in place in 1992, there has really been no broad review of the formula since that time. There have been numerous proposals before numerous revenue committees to actually change the formula. A few of those have actually went through. But in terms of a broad review, this was the first broad review the formula has ever had in almost a quarter of a century. The task force consisted of four legislators, myself as chair, Representative Comp, the vice chair, Senator Girard, and Representative Springer. There were nine public members. There were two superintendents, one school superintendent, one ESD superintendent, two teachers, a chief operating officer for a school district, and a business manager. Two school board members and a representative for virtual schools. Was very staffed by Assistant Superintendent Brian Reeder behind me and Jan McComb, the legislative coordinator for the Department of Education. Task force met 10 times. I will tell you quite honestly, it is the most well-attended task force I have ever been part of. The people were extremely diligent. I think it was rare that we even had one person absent during the task force deliberations. As the chair, I appointed three subcommittees, not to look broadly at all the issues before the task force, but at three issues in which the task force wanted to actually delve a little bit deeper. One of those was to look at the issue of equity itself. One is ELL, English language learners, and the third was high needs students. We held two public hearings. The first in March was very well attended, extremely well attended. The second one in August actually was less attended. We have some observations and then some recommendations. First of all, we want to reaffirm that the weighted factor model for funding allocation is working as intended. Now, I will tell you from my own personal experience being in this building for 19 years, there are numerous proposals put forward to amend the formula all the time. Most of the proposals I have seen are to the benefit of the school districts and the representative or state senator who is proposing them. That does not mean that the formula is perfect, but it's actually working as it was originally intended. We reaffirm also that it is an allocation model, not an expenditure model. We also found it very difficult to talk about equity, to talk about allocation, without talking about adequacy. And our fundamental issue was, if you have inadequate funds, just distributing them a little bit differently might improve the situation from some students. But if the funds are inadequate in the first place, you'll probably improve the situation for some students at the cost to other students. They were also concerned, and it's kind of interesting here, being here as the co-chair, they were also concerned about carve-outs from the state school fund. We have developed a practice of carving a little money here and there out of the state school fund, and they were concerned about that. They're also concerned about, in terms of recommendations, they think we should really look at the issue of adequacy, particularly in light of our lofty 40-40-20 goals and what that actually means. The other issue is in terms of a recommendation, and this is going to sound a little bit basic to some of you and a little bit boring, but one of the things that we lacked, we have an abundance of data. We always don't have all of the right data we need. Actually, some of the requests that have been made over the years and some of the improvements are getting better in terms of longitudinal data, but we actually need a study, a real funded study, if we were going to consider actually changing these weights. We need to look at what the actual costs in school districts are, do some comparisons in that, look at the results within school districts, look at best practices. This task force, like many that the legislature created, actually had one real drawback. It had no funding. It had very able staff from the Department of Ed, but it literally had no resources to actually do any kind of comprehensive study. And remember here that you're talking about the distribution of literally billions of dollars every biennium. We made some very specific recommendations. One is the issue of high-cost disabilities. High-cost disabilities, we've made some revisions in this over the years. About, I think, 2007, we actually put significant more money into this area. These are children in our new formula where they cost over $30,000, where the cost over $30,000 will be borne a portion by the state. It was originally envisioned that the cost borne by the state for students over $30,000 would be about 75% to 80%. Since we've never revisited that since we put more money into it, those numbers have fallen to about 40% of what we're covering. That can be very problematic for any school district. It is particularly problematic for small school districts if they end up with a handful of special needs, high disability, high-cost disability students, and they have to support that from the funding that they receive in the state school fund. Basic reason for that is it only takes three or four extra children in the 50, 60,000 range, and hopefully you don't get one that's in the $100,000 range, for a small school district to have to lose a classroom teacher somewhere else. Because like all public schools, they have to accept everyone who comes through the door and meet their needs. Also, there's been a long-term issue that Representative Comp has been working on, Senator Monroe, and the co-chairs of Ways and Means decided we'd try to solve it this time. It's over the issue of children that are in long-term care and treatment. They're not part of the normal formula. We're not suggesting they be part of the normal formula. But there are some considerable questions about the quality of the educational resources that they're receiving. And we're recommending, and there's a bill to this effect, that this actually be taken out of something that the Department of Ed contracts for, because it's actually terribly burdensome, because you have to create a contract with each school district. You have to negotiate that contract. You have to monitor the contract. And actually, the Department of Ed would have more control over the quality of education provided to these students if it was a grant and aid to them, because they can put in more specific requirements. ELL, the group spent a lot of time on ELL. One of the work groups spent a lot of time. Obviously, they looked at the proposal from the deputy superintendent in terms of changing the weight. At first, they were very intrigued by the proposal, but when they saw the proposal and they looked a little bit deeper, they started to come up with a long list of caveats of issues that would have to be resolved before you could implement the proposal. The reality is the whole education world became unglued when they saw that they were at first pushing the proposal, even though they didn't read perhaps the whole long list of caveats. Ultimately, they came to the conclusion that before you change the formula for ELL, you need to do a lot of study, because the issue may not be just simply the amount of funding. Point 5, if you look at it, even if this is an allocation model, is roughly about $3,500 per student. Mm-hmm. Most ELL students, not all, but probably 5 out of 6, are also in poverty. So it's actually a 0.5 plus a 0.25 weight. You'll hear about that soon. It'll be 0.175, which is actually meaning that there's over $10,000 per student once you include the basic original weight. The issue may not be just simply an issue of funding. The issue is probably an issue in terms of how many qualified ELL teachers you have, how many of you are trying to get through our teachers' colleges or universities that we have right now, whether they are qualified, what kind of resources you provide them. And it's also an issue that ELL students are not a monolithic group. Some schools may only have one language or two languages that are not English. Beaverton is the winner. In a sense, it has, I believe, 100 languages to address an ELL. Students come with that are fluent in their own languages. Students come that have been not in any sort of academic environment in their life, and they're 9 or 10 years old, and they're a refugee from perhaps somewhere in the Sudan or something like that. So ELL students are not a monolithic group. Finally, we think that the Department of Ed needs to be able to gather better information about the expenditures of funds on ELL students so we can actually do the kind of study we need. And we just advise further research. Now, finally, there's one last item that they expressed a concern about. This is an item that tears people in all directions. There has become a growing practice in school districts of allowing students to attend a fifth year, even though they have actually completed all the credits that they would need to complete, even though they have completed all the requirements. The reason they're doing this, and I think it's very well intentioned, is that they are trying to find transitions for those students into post-secondary education, largely community colleges. The concern that is expressed is that the policy is way out in front of actually the formula, and the use of this is out in advance of the policy, in a sense, because as I think most of you know, and I don't know if there's anybody here that's going to be, there might be one or two new to the formula, but the reality is we actually put a significant amount of state money into the state school formula. That's matched with local money. Then we determine, in a sense, what the amount per ADMW is. So we basically take a big number in terms of funding it and divide it by a very big number. So if students are staying on from the 12th grade on to an additional year, they're increasing the number of ADMW. So they're actually providing the big number in terms of funding is going to be divided by an even larger number than it is now. Mm-hmm. And so you actually effectively reduce the amount of funding that you have for every other student. The group was very concerned about this, thinks something needs to be done this session. From a personal standpoint, I actually believe as a state senator something needs to be done, but I think it's a little bit more difficult than it appears on the surface, because I know how many years this body has actually struggled with trying to find ways to get more children. I guess at my age I can start calling a 17-year-old a child. But to get more young people into post-secondary education. And I think some of the school districts that are doing this are very well intentioned. And I will leave my testimony at that and turn it over to my very able colleague to my left.
Great. And as she's getting ready to get started, I want to note that I have to be in another committee in a few minutes to testify on a bill. And so if I get up and leave in the middle, it has nothing whatever to do with your testimony. And with that, Representative Comp, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. I will probably be very brief because I didn't hear all of Senator Devlin's comments, but my name is Betty Comp. I serve House District 22, Woodburn, Jervis, and Brooks. Senator Devlin and I really had I think it was a great learning opportunity as we delved into the funding formula deeper than we normally have. I know you as people on the Revenue Committee really have a good grasp of it. And when we had the task force, the group that was participating were superintendents, business directors from school districts, teachers, a nice range of some really smart people, and the couple of major issues that did come up were the English language learner and I can't remember her name right now, Senator, that was so good.
You mean the member of the committee?
Yeah.
I remember because we're not related, but her name, I think, is Kelly Devlin.
Yeah, Kelly Devlin. And she had been a classroom teacher for quite some time, and she knew the ELL funding situation inside and out and gave a lot of perspective to other members on the task force that they really hadn't thought about. And then one of our superintendents was the person that really brought up the issue about the fifth year program that's happening in some of those schools. And we came to the conclusion at the end, other than the high cost disability grant that we agreed that needs, you did all that?
No, go ahead.
We needed to have some more equity there, and again, there was not a transference of cost that was being moved from one district to another, and part of that was when a student would be moved from Portland to Astoria or vice versa, and Portland would be getting the money for another 6 months, and Astoria would be sitting there waiting. And might not ever get it. So that is the one piece of legislation that has come out of our work. And it may seem like a small thing, but it is on that road to equity so that when you have, particularly for high cost disability, it is a huge amount for a district, especially a small district, to have to do without that because there's just glitches in the pathway. So I felt really good about our work. The final recommendations from at least 95% of the people, if not all of us, was that this is a much bigger issue than most people realize. And we did have the presentation from the deputy superintendent about changing the ELL formula. I believe there are several bills on that subject this session, so we'll have an opportunity to debate those. And other than that, I mean, it was just a good group of educators learning from each other and helping us see what they saw and felt. So we're open to questions, and if you guys have all the solutions, we can just leave, right?
Right. Senator.
Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, there's only one other thing, or two actually. One is that when you think about high-cost disability grants and the students are impacted, the latest data that we received in the task force was this impacts 98 out of 198 school districts. So this is not a select group. So just to know, it's the entire state that's impacted. Secondarily, if you'd like to read the report, and I would encourage you to read the report, it's not particularly long for a government report, it's only 40 pages. And it has a lot of the background that Mr. Reeder will probably go through today. It is available online, and I don't know if your good staff has made it available to the committee.
Is it in the...
Mr. Chair, it's in OLS, yes.
It's in our
meeting materials.
It's in our meeting materials for today. I thought it was.
Right. And Mr. Representative Barnhart, I would really, again, encourage, if this is something that excites you, and I'm not being facetious, delve into it and really look at it, because if and when decisions will be made, it's really important that we know why we're doing those.
Thank you very much. Questions, comments, Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you both for your service. I know that's not an easy capacity to serve in. As somebody who works in the education realm quite a bit, I wonder if there's a way, if we do this again, if we take another crack at this, could the conversation be framed differently rather than simply trying to ensure that the formula continues to maintain the equities in it that I think it probably does, and that's kind of been kind of the founding principles behind it, to actually trying to incentivize the kind of outcomes that I think our students and our state really need to have. Because this, other states are having these this conversation as well. And some states are really making some significant progress on incentivizing various economic outcomes, or not economic, but academic outcomes for students, because really that's what it's all about. The formula just doesn't exist to make sure that everybody gets an equal share of mediocrity. The formula ought to exist to incentivize some really truly outcomes that are good for kids, good for our economy, you know, that kind of thing. So is there a way that we could do that if we reauthorize the task force again, to give that task force perhaps some instructions to really try to do some, look for ways that we could do things better, so that we could get better academic outcomes?
39 pages, though.
I think there are some ways you could, and actually I'd reference back to the report. One is to do the underlying groundwork that actually needs to be done. And secondarily, I did leave off because I didn't want to go through every recommendation that's in here, is that this review should be done more frequently than every 23, 24 years. We're recommending at least every 8, and actually if you funded the study this time, maybe it should be done in 2 or 3 years from now again. The other thing, though, is I think you have to look at the overall cost of providing what you consider necessary PK through 12, if you're talking about that area. And then as you want to incentivize things, you have to be careful that you're providing the funding from those incentives. Mm-hmm. You're not taking it away from the basic costs of providing classroom instructions to other students. And so it's the fundamental problem that the co-chairs saw in the governor's budget. Because we haven't really funded K through 12 in the co-chair's budget at anything that I'll go home. Well, my mother's no longer alive and hasn't been for many years, that I'll go tell Mom what a great job I did. What we basically did was try to fund it at enough of a level where most school districts will not be laying off teachers again, and they will not be losing school days, and will reasonably fund kindergarten. There's nothing really extra in the state school fund other than that. The reality is what the governor did was he took $325 million away from the number that we had, mm-hmm. and funded a whole lot of other new initiatives. That's why we will not have as much money for those new initiatives, because we tried to fund actually the base level. I think what you need to do is to find the resources to actually do the initiatives, mm-hmm. in terms of incentivizing people. Mr. Chairman, I apologize, yep. but I'm due somewhere else in 5 minutes. So.
Great. Well, I have one question before you leave then. Yeah. Given the wonderful introduction that you gave to the need for a review, I assume that you'll be promoting with the Ways and Means Committee the funding of an actual study that actually will have, yes. the funds necessary in order to do a real review of the details of the funding formula, so that that many billions of dollars that you referred to will be spent as efficiently as possible.
Yeah, will do.
Thank you very much. And I assume that you both will be lobbying the Committee on Education, where the high cost school, the high cost student bill now resides on its way here.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate it. Can you stay for a few minutes longer,
sure.
Representative? Are there other questions for the representative? Representative, what's it, please?
And mine is sort of a comment from teachers that I have heard both in and out of my district, that the ELL money is not always going to the students, that it's going into the districts, and the students that it's intended for are not receiving it. And I was wondering if we have any bills coming up this session that would address that, because it's a concern of some of the teachers that have approached me. It becomes part of their formula then, but, you know, the local districts, but it's not getting where it's supposed to go. It's viewed as an extra pot of money that's going in and spent on other things.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt. The reality is there are bills. The bill that would look at changing the ELL formula does exactly that. It directs the school districts that the money should be spent on the ELL student. So that issue will be coming up. Another bill that will be coming before the body this cycle is there's a bill out there about how much is the allocation for charter schools or virtual schools. So, yes, there are several things that will be coming about.
Great, thanks.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for all your work on this. Could you share with us just perhaps a list of what you viewed as the greatest inequities that you did see in the formula that I can understand why you wouldn't want to attack all of them, but maybe you could just share with us several that didn't rise to the level of you asking us to do something about them, but nonetheless are apparent.
I have a niche in my heart for, particularly special ed, but even more than that, teen parents. Teen parents right now come under the category of special education, so the funding formula allows a 0.25. And there is quite a difference between the needs for a young mother or a young father. But if you look at the family as we're looking at in early education, it's just as important that that young father's out in a daycare center helping take care of that new young person. The dropout rate for teen moms is very high. Unbelievably, when I was a middle school principal, I had 12-year-olds that were pregnant, and we helped them. We made sure that they had a curriculum and that they were progressing still through their pregnancy. But once the baby was born, anybody that has a child knows how much time it takes to raise a baby. And I don't think we really have, well, I know we don't. We don't have a good pathway for them to get back into the system to help them finish their education. And the younger they are, the harder it is. But that is an area that I think is not equitable. But that's my own personal bias.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Well, it's not too surprising. I always have a reason for asking the question, and here it is. It seems to me in my travels across the state that the communities with money, I'm going to use Hillsborough as an example, enjoy a better educational experience than, let's say, any other place. Mm-hmm. I could use places in Portland easily enough. But the formula doesn't necessarily address those issues, such as the ability to raise money for new buildings, like the $500 million that was just passed in Portland. And other communities that simply don't have that ability because of their economic circumstance. This formula doesn't address those issues. Or maybe it does, and I just don't know it, but I doubt it. So my question is, how did this study, or what do we do to, if this study didn't identify those inequities, what do we do to get them a little further up the radar?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, there is another bill that people are working on. I think Representative Reed might know about it, but it's about capital construction. I think we have failed in the state of Oregon to help keep our buildings in shape, and so that there's no money in the general fund for any kind of maintenance, seismic work, in those things. And I think it's time to start that conversation. I personally, as a school principal, thought we should have started that conversation 25 years ago. When I would go through our school with a fire marshal a couple times every year, and he would always remind me, and he would say, well, Betty, you know, from this hallway to this hallway, because we had no walls, there were cement in between. He said it will take 90 seconds for a fire to get from one end of this building to the other end of this building. And if you think about a middle school, and you have 500 or 450 students and 50 staff members.
That would be ironic.
That's a lot of people to get out of a building at in 90 seconds. And the reality is we would have tremendous fatalities. And so, I mean, there's so many messages that we need to send about how we're looking at all these issues, whether it's asbestos, whether it's seismic. We've got a lot of work.
Correct. Final remark, Mr.
Yes, please. Yes.
So I agree with everything you said. But my question was, I wanted to expand it beyond just physical plant.
Okay.
And ask what we're doing to identify the inequities that are in the broader system, because the physical one is clear, but there are others. And I just want to make sure that we are not ignoring them as we go forward. I see them. I saw several today in some of the bills that came across my desk, that the proposed bills that are going to inure to the benefit of those in the wealthy parts of the state, but not everywhere else. And that seems wrong. In fact, I don't think it's even constitutional. The question is, who's making the list of those things so that we can better understand why you're better off if you're born and go to school in Hillsboro than if you're born and go to school in Sile? I mean, what is the, not to pick on Sile, but why not? That's my point. Where do we look to see the difference in educational experience as a result of what we can do in this building, not other circumstances, but here?
Representative Barnhart and Representative Bentz, I would assure you that the report that Mr. Reeder is going to show you will have some of that very information. The key area that we've looked at, that the researchers and the OEIB board have looked at for inequities, has been in the early childhood education. So another one is the Children's Institute. They have a request in for an additional $30 million because there's not very many children that can get into Head Start, so they can get into that pathway so that they're prepared. Those are some, right there in early childhood is some of our biggest inequities. And I have, Senator Monroe and I have asked for absolutely data and outcomes from the OEIB board and our leadership there, because, well, it's just critical. And a lot of us, I don't know how this committee feels, but if we're going to look at equities, we need to start when they're little, so that we can really make, well, and then they can, if they can read, then the world's theirs.
Certainly, Chua, thank you for that thought, and thank you for your work. Are there further questions for the representative? Seeing none, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Co-Chair, well, Vice Chair Bentz.
Thank you. And is Paul, is it Mr. Reeder that's up next?
Well, and Dayback.
And, oh, Dave.
They've got all the good stuff.
Thank you again.
Good afternoon, First Chair Bentz and members of the committee. For the record, this is Dave Back, Legislative Revenue Office. Heard the testimonies from Senator Devlin and Rep. Comp. So it's high time to look at formula itself. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you an overview of a school fund revenue distribution, and then I'll leave the task of difficult task of just discussing details of the formula itself to Mr. Brian Reeder. So the second page, yeah. So the revenue available is the sum of state school fund that the legislature appropriates, and local revenues of school districts and education service districts, mostly property taxes. And after carve-outs from the top, school districts gets 95.5%, and ESDs get 4.5%. Within school districts and educational service districts shares their statutory defined grants and distribution. So the goal is to get to the next page, the distribution chart. But to understand that, let me give you a little big picture. So it's an accounting. Could be used as a cheat sheet when certain policies are discussed. So state school fund plus local revenue becomes the dollars available for school districts and ESDs. So from there, we subtract so-called carve-outs and set-asides. There are small high school grants, talented gifted program, speech pathology, virtual school district, and NQTL, Network for Quality Teaching and Learning, long-term care and treatment, Oregon School for the Deaf, pediatric nursing facility, and reserves, mm-hmm. and some others. There are some language in ORS that is specified for certain programs, but not actually appropriated every biennium. Some numbers are specified for these programs, but at the there are some programs that are whose numbers are not really specified. Dollar figures are not specified. So after these carve-outs and set-asides,
we have a question, Representative Johnson.
Please.
Could you or do you know the percentage of the total state school fund that these carve-outs and the set-asides equal approximately right now?
It depends on,
for the previous biennium, perhaps?
It should be about $80 million or so.
$80 million out of 6 point.
Okay, so let me go back. Yeah. And then last biennium, it's state school fund was about $6.65 billion. Yeah. And local revenue about a little over $3 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And this set aside at this point, it was about $80 million.
About $80 million, yeah. Sum total. Thank you. That's good.
And I'm sure Mr. Reeder has a little more information. But obviously, legislature can change the figures.
Right.
So after these subtractions becomes formula revenue to be distributed to SDs and ESDs, starts the formula here. 95.5% belongs to the state school school districts, and 4.5% belongs to ESDs. So out of school district share, 95.5%, and subtract high cost disabilities grant, at this point it's $36 million, $18 million per biennium, a year, $36 million a biennium. Facility grant is at $20 million at this point per biennium. And school district share of NQTL, Quality Teaching Network. Last biennium it was $14 million. With these subtractions becomes the formula revenue available for distribution to school districts. So when you hear a discussion about high-cost disability grant, it's the money that's taken out of school district's distribution. Facility grant actually went down last biennium from 25 in the previous biennium to $20 million. So 4.5% ESD share. You got to subtract 10th grade assessment, about $1 million biennium. And ESD share of NQTL, it's the same amount as coming out from school districts, about 14 million last biennium. So for the entire quality teaching network last biennium, we spent 33, five off the top, and 14 and 14 together became 33 million. So for ESD, after subtracting 10th grade assessment and ESD share of NQTL, it becomes formula revenue available for distribution for ESDs. Go back one a page before. So when you discuss a small high school grant, it's taken off the top, and it's not gonna it's gonna reduce the formula revenue available. The same with other programs. Now there are some set asides that dollar figures are not specified, but ODE is mandated to provide education service for. These figures will be probably discussed and determined by Ways and Means. So with that, I'm going to turn over to Mr. Brian Reeder about the details of current formula and the task force recommendations.
Okay, hold on. Any questions for Day? No? Okay, Mr. Reeder. Thank you for that. And I did have one question. Those items, I saw you called out $5 million on one. Is there some place where the numbers on each of those carve-outs are located?
So, for example, small high school grant is specified as $5 million, 2.5 per year. Talented and gifted, 350. Speech pathology.
But since I can't remember them, are there some, is there some place I can?
Oh yes, if you could send ORS 327.008.
And they're called out specifically there.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. One more for follow-up on the small schools, high school. Now, there is a weighting formula for small high schools as well, where I think it's two times, correct, in the formula. But this small school grant you're referring to that's about $5 million is a supplemental or an additional?
That's additional, yes.
On top of that?
Yes.
And how is that awarded, do you know?
Brian's going to discuss
Brian's
this small school corrections.
Yes.
But Vice Chair Vance and Representative Johnson, details. For continuity and flow of discussion, I guess it's best for Brian to discuss current formula first.
Go ahead.
So Vice Chair Vance, members of the committee, Brian Reeder, Assistant Superintendent in the Office of Research and Data Analysis at Department of Education. I'm going to go over the formula in a little more detail than Day did. I'm also going to give you a little more background on school district revenue, total revenue, and then the formula's place in that picture. Some of this will be a little redundant. I'll try to go over that part a little more quickly. So what I want to do is talk about where the funding comes from, how much it is, how it gets out to school districts and ESDs, and what the key education cost drivers have been over the last 25 years or so. Here's a picture of revenue by source. This is all operating revenue, not just the amount that comes through the formula, state, local, and federal revenue. And this is annual revenue by year over the 25-year period. I started back in 1990-91 because that really is the last year before the effects of Measure 5 kicked in, which is really a watershed event in Oregon history for the funding of schools. Here's the magnitudes of that. 53% of the revenue going to K-12 schools, and this is both districts and ESDs, in 2012-13. That's the latest year we have audited data from all of our districts and ESDs. 53% from the state, 37 from local, and 10 from federal. Now, if you go back to pre-Measure 5 days, those state and local percentages were pretty much reversed, about two-thirds coming from local property taxes and the remaining non-federal amount, roughly 60% coming from the state. I'm sorry, 30% coming from the state. So you look at the federal part, the bulk of it, nearly 90%, comes to the Department of Education, and we simply pass it through to school districts. These are the title programs, Title I for low-income students, Title III for English as a second language students, and so forth. The federal government does send some grants directly to school districts. That's the pink portion there, about 8%. And then federal forest fees, which in 12-13 we still got a little bit of federal forest fees. The local portion is dominated by property taxes, 77% directly from property taxes, a relatively large amount, 17% from fees and charges that school districts charge to their students, and those are things like sports fees and extracurricular activities where there will be fees involved.
Yes, excuse me, Representative Smith Warner.
Can I just do a quick check? Would that fees section include the charge that many districts did for full-day kindergarten? Is that where it would be reflected?
Vice Chair Bentz, Representative Smith Warner, yes.
Okay.
Those are in the nature. I mean, sometimes they would be referred to as tuition, but they would be in that category, yes.
Thank you.
Private donations at 1%, and those actually vary considerably around the state. Some districts having much larger private donations than others. And then other levels of government, cities and counties in particular, sometimes pass along some of their revenue to their local school districts, either in forms of cash or in an example would be where a school is built next to a city park where they will share the cost of maintaining that. It's a school playground during the day, and it's a public park when school's not in session. And then the state share, obviously, dominated by the state school fund, which is funded through both income taxes and lottery dollars, 92%. There are some state grants that go directly to school districts that don't flow through our funding formula. The common school fund and then state managed timber revenues that also flow through to school districts. So a little history. The current formula was adopted by the 91 legislature, and it became effective in the 92-93 school year. It really hasn't changed significantly since then in its basic structure. The biggest changes that really have been in the types of carve-outs that exist in the formula. There have been some minor changes to the transportation funding portion. So of the total amount of money that the formula distributes, about 95% of it goes out through the basic formula on a weighted student basis, and we'll talk a little bit more about what weighted students are in a few minutes. The goal of the formula is to distribute money in an equitable way. If you look at the law that was passed back in 1991, it talks about equity in terms of compensating for costs outside of district control. In other words, are there variable costs that districts face in one part of the state or from one district to another that are outside of their control? And to the extent that those vary across districts, the formula is intended to compensate for those. An example would be transportation. We have some small rural districts that spend more than $2,000 per student just transporting their kids to and from school. The statewide average is about $300. So massive difference there. The transportation part of our formula is designed to compensate for those big differences. Without that, those schools that have very high transportation costs would be eating up their instructional dollars just to get their kids to school. ODE calculates the formula amounts for each school district and each ESD. Keep in mind that the formula allocates both state dollars and local dollars. And so we calculate that total amount that each district and ESD gets through the formula, and then the state sends out the portion that the districts haven't collected themselves already from their local property taxes and other sources of local revenue. For example, if a district is entitled to $10 million through the formula and they raise $4 million on their own, the state sends them $6 million in state school fund money. Another district that's also entitled to $10 million may raise only $2 million on their own, so the state sends them $8 million in state school fund money. That's the equalization portion of the formula. And the last point on this slide is that neither ODE nor the formula prescribes how districts spend those dollars. Those are local decisions. A lot of discussion lately about maybe changing some of that. But under the law, there really are no strings attached to the dollars that the state sends to school districts through the formula. We looked at, started out by looking at total revenue of school districts. About 80% of their total revenue, operating revenue, goes through the formula. The other 20% are grants and other sources, such as local option property taxes that they receive, but that don't come to them through the formula. So the formula is the biggest game in town, but it's not the only game in town. And what you'll see here in a minute is that we really have three sources of revenue for schools in Oregon: federal, state, and local. But when we get to the formula, we redefine that as only two categories, state and local. But what you'll see is in that local category, some of them really originate with the federal government and some of them originate with state government, but they are shared with school districts, so they're already in the hands of the school districts before the formula operates, so they're called local revenue in the context of the formula. And as Dave mentioned, 95.5% of the total formula revenue goes to school districts, 4.5% to ESDs. So here's the two categories of revenue when we talk about the formula itself. And under local revenue, we've got property taxes, which are by far the biggest part, the Common School Fund, and federal forest fees. Those are federal revenues, but they come through our formula as though they are local revenues because they're already in the hands of local governments or local school districts. County School Fund, state-managed timber, again, a state source, but already in the hands of school districts. Excess ESD revenue, that's a complicated story that maybe I'll leave for another day if you're interested in it. We can talk about it later if you're interested in it. And then a small amount of what are called revenue in lieu of taxes, various programs where individuals or businesses will pay a fee or some other amount in lieu of a property tax because they qualify for an abatement program or something like that. Those are also part of the formula, local revenue. So you can see that on the state side, almost two-thirds, and this is actually in the last few years, the state portion has come down as we move through this prolonged recession that we've been in. Property tax revenues under the provisions of Measure 50 are pretty stable. They grow, you know, for an individual property, their assessed value grows at 3% as long as it's below market value. So what we've seen is a real stabilization of property tax revenues, but Oregon's income tax revenue still remains a fairly volatile source of revenue as we see changes in the economy. So here's a history of formula revenue, and you can see that, I mean, the stability in local revenue started in in the late 90s that prolonged or 5 or 6 year decline is the phase in of Measure 5. You see a 1 year blip up in 96, 97, and then Measure 50 kicks in and we went down again. But since then, the growth has been remarkably stable. In contrast, state revenue has jumped around considerably. You can see the recession in the early 2000s, and then you can see the recession in the late 2000s.
Are these in constant dollars?
No, these
are in actual dollars.
These are actual dollars, yes.
Okay.
We'll get into some inflation-adjusted dollars here in a few minutes.
So local revenue has never recovered to the level it had at the beginning of your chart.
It's just now getting there, yes.
In actual dollars?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. Go ahead.
So, as I mentioned, the way the formula works is it takes those sources, the state school fund and those series of local revenue sources, and in effect puts it all into one big pot. And that pot turns out to be somewhere between $4.5 and $5 billion right now per year when you add the state and local dollars together. And then that money, we take the carve-outs off the top, and then what's left we distribute through the formula, and I'll show you the equation here in a minute. It's remarkably simple. And we distribute it based on the number of weighted students that each district has and the number of weighted students that the districts that are served by each ESD have. And then the state actually cuts a check to districts for the amount that they haven't raised themselves locally. So here's one of my favorite graphs that shows how exactly the formula equalizes the funding per weighted student. The blue part is local revenue and the red part is state revenue, and it demonstrates fairly clearly that the state portion is designed to get each district up to a given amount per weighted student, independent of how much the local district raises by itself. So these are our per ADMW, and this is 12-13, and this excludes the transportation portion of it because that's not distributed on a weighted student basis. But you can see that it gets every district to just about the same amount, just right around a little bit over $6,000 on average. The reason that they differ a little bit, and the only reason that they differ a little bit, is a provision in our formula that's referred to as the teacher experience adjustment. That gives $25 per ADMW more to school districts that have above average experience for each year that they have above average experience. So the state average right now is about 13 years. So if my district has an average of 14 years, I get $25 per ADMW because of that. If my district has only 12 years, I'm below average, then I lose $25 per ADMW because of my lower teacher experience. The rationale is that given teacher salary schedules in Oregon, which are driven largely by experience, that districts with very high experience teachers have higher costs, and therefore the formula gives them additional revenue. And you'll see on the far right-hand end that there are a few. Right now there are six, I believe, school districts.
Give me just a moment. Representative
Smith, that is just what I was going to ask. So,
oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Does this really show that there are X number of districts that it's all local?
Yes. We have six school districts where their local revenue exceeds what the formula guarantees them, so they don't get any money from the state for what we call the general purpose grant. They do get transportation money. Mm-hmm. And they will qualify for the other, you know, the carve-outs and so forth that are distributed in other ways.
These are very small districts, aren't they?
They are. They are typically districts that have a source of revenue, a somewhat unusual source of revenue. So Nestucca Valley School District has a lot of state timber revenue. Neocony has a lot of second homes where they have lots of property value but very few students. Seaside is in this category for the same reason. So talk a little bit about weighted students, which is really the driver of the distributional portion of our formula. The logic behind this is the one I described earlier. These are costs that are considered to be outside the control of school districts. So our formula gives them extra money to compensate for those higher costs. These costs here, with all with the exception of the last one, are based on the characteristics of students. So we've got special education students get an additional weight. English as a second language students get an extra half weight. Students in poverty an extra quarter weight, and so forth. This is really the core of the distribution formula, and this is really the in conversations about changing the formula because it may be perceived as not achieving Oregon's equity goals. This is the core of what drives our vision of equity in terms of distribution of school funding dollars. So if the policymakers decide that our notion of equity is not being achieved, this is essentially where changes would need to be made to fix that if we're going to stay with this type of funding formula, weighted student formula.
Thank you. Representative Vega Peterson.
This is so interesting to look at this because you have a lot of kind of policy decisions, look, you know, and judgments on the different weights that are given here. Can you talk just a little bit in terms of do you know what factors were looked at in determining like how much, let's say, you know, poverty, for instance, impacts a school's ability to serve that student? Or, you know, I mean, Representative Johnson had talked about, you know, let's take a look at outcomes maybe instead of equality. I'm just very curious about that.
If I could interrupt, this is precisely the question that we hoped we were going to get answered by the task force that we heard from at the beginning of this meeting and which they admitted they weren't able to answer. But, I mean, it's a great question. Yeah, go ahead. See what you can do with it.
Yeah, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Vega Peterson. I think you've hit the nail on the head in terms of the discussions, not just in Oregon, but nationwide about equity in public schooling. If you go back to when our formula was devised, I think what people will tell you, I personally wasn't working in fact, I don't know that I was even in Oregon at the time. But what people have expressed to me is that we looked at how other states organized their formulas and at what level they compensated districts for different students in different circumstances, students who might need extra resources. And we sort of adopted some version or some average or relied heavily on what other states were doing without much serious consideration of an outcomes-based view. If you go back more than about 10 years, most of the discussions of equity in schooling had to do with inputs, not outcomes. And so I think the weights we currently have in our formula, which have not changed, were developed in that era where we had such disparities in the level of inputs around the country and among school districts within states, including Oregon. You know, we had some districts spending more than twice as much per student as other districts. Those disparities on the input side were so large that was the focus, and we weren't really talking about equity and outcomes. In the last 10 years, that conversation has changed fairly dramatically. Mm-hmm. The way that most researchers and analysts have looked at an outcomes-based approach to equity is to say, what does it cost? And it's a cost basis, just like, you know, in some sense, an inputs-based one is a cost basis. What does it cost to get all students up to a desired level of student achievement? And the hard part is to say, what is that desired level? Do we expect it to be the same for all students, or if not, do we set a minimum level that we expect every student to achieve, knowing that some will soar above that? But do we set a minimum level where we want every student to be able to make it? And then look at the level of resources required to make that happen. But a prerequisite to that is to know what it is, what your notion of equity really is. Is it still income input-based, or is it outcomes-based? And those are two very different ways to look at it. Those are questions that the task force did grapple with, but you know, as we know, equity is a value judgment that varies from person to person. Doesn't mean we can't talk about it in a meaningful way, but you won't always get agreement about what your equity goals are. I think the task force did agree that they thought that an outcomes-based view of equity was the appropriate one for Oregon to take. What that means is, in looking at our formula, that should be our measure of success. Do we have outcomes for our students that we consider equitable? And what kind of funding mechanism does it take to get there? Mm-hmm. Really hard questions.
And I appreciate that very thoughtful answer. I would just say, you know, it is really hard to dig into what equity means, but we have really set the goals of the 40-40-20, and I think one of the outcomes that we've all agreed on is to have, 40-40-20 in terms of high school graduation and college graduation rates, and so I think that's a good starting point for that conversation of what we need to get to that, at least that outcome at the very basic level.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Leininger.
So I know that we've just moved into the era of full-day kindergarten, but I'm noticing that it's still funded at a 0.5, or the weight seems to be 0.5. What does that mean? Is that interim, or is that going to change? What does that mean?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Leininger, the 0.5 weight will change to 1.0 when full-day kindergarten kicks in, I believe, next year. So this is...
If a district decides to go there.
Right. This is current law. I think the new law says if a district offers full-day kindergarten, they will get a full weight for those students.
Got it. Let me
get
back
to there. Representative Johns?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just again, a comment. I think Brian's defined the issue really well, but this is a conversation that really can be beneficial if you can provide some different perspective to the conversation. And when we have a task force of folks who are used to dealing with the same situation for quite some time, it's hard to fathom how things could be done differently. And that's where looking at what other states are doing and what other states have done, you know, NCSL, if you really want to look for some stuff, it's great to go there and to see what other formula allocations look like, Education Commission of the states and stuff. So, you know, we do 0.5 for ESL, ELL students. Other states can be 0.6, 0.25. I mean, there's a range. So, again, it's good to bring in some other perspectives on just what can be done and what could be considered and what are the motivations for having different funding allocations. So you can get really deep here if you want to, right, Brian?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leininger, if I may add, my understanding is co-chair's budget framework includes in it the full-day kinder funding, I think at a little over $200 million. So that's counted in co-chair's budget framework.
Thank you. I think you have some more slides. Yes.
So just some definitional things here. Average daily membership weighted, which is, as I mentioned, drives our formula, starts with average daily membership, which is simply a count of students adjusted for how long they were in school during the year. So if a student's only in an Oregon school for half the year, they would be counted as a half an ADM. And then we add the weights. And currently, in the ADM numbers, kindergartners are at 0.5. They will go up to 1.0 next year. And then what we call ADMW extended, and that is once we calculate ADMW for a given year, we use for funding purposes the higher of the current year and the prior year. And that is designed to provide a bit of a cushion or a soft landing for districts that are losing student enrollment over time. It funds them on their prior year, so they get a little extra money as they lose students, understanding that costs often don't go down as quickly as your enrollment does. So just some numbers. 12-13 school year, about 534,000 in average daily membership, about 655,000 or 656, excuse me, in once you add the weights. And then when you take the higher of the current year and the prior year, it gets you up to just about 660,000 weighted students. That's about 23 to 24% above ADM. So the weights add about 24% to the student count that we're actually funding. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So here's the formula itself. Pretty simple. You take each district's ADMW extended and you multiply it by this $4,500 target. And that was in the initial law back in 1991 and hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. And then you add this teacher experience adjustment that I talked about. So that's going to be $25 for each year that your experience differs from the statewide average. And then, because that $4,500 is low relative to the amount of money we actually have to give out, we have what we call the balance ratio, which makes sure that we give out all the money. And so you can see the history of these ratios for the last 10 years or so, and they tend to grow over time as we have more money to give out. Because that $4,500 isn't changing, that ratio grows as our budget for schools grow. And you can see the recessions in there too in the early 2000s, where we go down a little bit in 04, 05, and then we start back up, and then in 08, 09 we start back down again for a couple years, and then now we're headed back up again as the economy climbs out of the recession.
Now, this formula was adopted in 1991.
Right, and started with the 92-93 school year.
Okay.
And in those early years, there were some hold harmless provisions so that we wouldn't have high-spending districts lose a lot of money all at once.
Right.
And that phase in, do you remember, Paul, late 90s is
late
when,
90s.
When that phase in
98, 99.
Was done. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative.
So just a couple quick questions about this. So that $4,500 target, it was established when the formula was first created.
Correct.
So one would assume that in 1992 the thought was, well, you know, who knows? I'm not saying they just picked it out of the air, but they said, okay, about $4,500 per student is about what these schools are doing now, whatever.
Correct.
That would have been where it came from. But it has not, and it has not been adjusted since then or changed. That is what the balance is supposed to do. Is it supposed to account for inflation, that balance ratio?
Representative Barnhart, Representative Smith Warner, the balance ratio really compensates for the fact that the $4,500 is low relative to the amount of money we have. It's really not about compensating for inflation.
It's really
on the budget side that the legislature needs to compensate for inflation. Hmm. It's simply to say, you know, if we didn't have that ratio and we had $4.5 billion to give out, this, without that ratio, this formula would only give out about $3.5 billion. So you set that ratio above one so that it gives out all of the money.
It's simply a way of truing up the formula against the actual budget amount. Mm. That's it.
So that, which answers my question of how is that balance ratio? So it is determined based on the number that the budget comes up with, the final budget number.
Correct.
And you do it backwards, don't you?
Yeah.
I mean, you know how much this formula produces. You know what the budget is, and you compare the two numbers and divide from that this balance ratio, which you then can go back and use to multiply to get the different distribution amounts.
Chair Barnhart, that's correct. We're the Department of Ed. We do everything backwards.
Well, the legislature did it to you in this case, so yes, you don't have to apologize for that one. Representative, did you have some others?
And did there not used to, was there not a balance ratio before 2002?
You know, the distribution, yes, there was. I just, with limited space, I just put the recent ones on here. You know, if you go back to when the formula started in about 92, 93, it would have been very close to one. And then as the budget grew, it would climb above one. And then you can see in 02, 03, it actually fell below one again, which sort of gives you a sense of how difficult that recession in the early 2000s was.
That was the year of five special sessions when we could not balance the budget.
Yeah, I remember that. Okay, thank you.
So just a little bit of detail about the portions of the formula that are not based on, strictly on ADMW, the teacher experience adjustment, the high-cost disability grant, the transportation grants, which are really reimbursements for what districts actually spend on transportation, and then the facilities grant, which we've already talked about a little, that they talked about a little bit. They are grants for districts that have put in place new buildings to help them buy desks and other items that prior to a couple years ago they could not use bond money for. We have since changed the Constitution so that they now can. And the facilities grant was phased down from $25 to $20 million in the 13 session, I believe, and don't know whether the intent is to phase it out completely or not. So a little bit about education cost drivers. It's really driven by the number of students that we have in Oregon and their characteristics. Those categories of students that require added resources and for whom we pay extra weights have tended to grow faster than the general student population. Salaries, clearly 80% of costs in education are salaries and benefits. You can see here that salary is about 51, benefits about 28. Benefits in Oregon are relatively high compared to other states, primarily because of the retirement system rate we currently have in Oregon is quite high. So here's a sense for some growth rates in those items that I've identified here as cost drivers. Total enrollment going up at about 0.7% a year over the last 24, 25 years. Special ed students, 2.2% a year on average. Limiting English proficient, over 8% a year. Now, what's happened in the last few years is that's flattened out. But in the early years of the formula, students whose first language was not English were growing very, very rapidly in Oregon. In terms of sheer numbers, they're still growing, but as in percentage terms, it's flattened out a bit because we've got 60,000 students in the system. 20 years ago, we only had 10,000. Teacher salaries growing at about 2.4% a year on average. Fairly steadily, not a lot of variation in that. You can see the PERS rate has more than doubled over this time period. And health insurance rates have gone up. although that a two is a place where we've seen it start to flatten out a little bit, partly because a lot of districts have put caps on the amount they're willing to pay, so that anything above those amounts are paid by the employees, and some have argued that costs themselves have grown a little bit slower under the reforms that the Obama administration has put in. A little bit on where Oregon ranks nationally in terms of our funding. This is 1991, again, sort of a starting point before our property tax limitations. Oregon was ranked 15th that year. I didn't put the national average in here, but we were, I think, somewhere about 10% above the national average at the time. 2011-12, which is the last year that we have national data that compares all the states, Oregon had fallen to 33rd rank in the nation, and about, and I don't know the percentage here, but about 10% below the national average now, so a big swing in this period. And this last slide will give you a sense about how that happened. If you look at the total percent change in funding per student over this period, Oregon was next to last, above only Florida. Over that period, our expenditures per student grew 82% total, whereas on the upper end, Wyoming's grew 200%. Now, you got to take Wyoming into North Dakota with a grain of salt there, because they're swimming in oil money at the moment, and they have sent a lot of money into their education systems because of that. But the overall trend here is one of investing much less than other states in our education system since the passage of Measure 5. Here's some inflation adjustments. If you take formula funding per actual student, you can see the top line is unadjusted dollars. The bottom line is adjusted dollars. Over this period, that's about a 12% decline in funding per student. If you do it funding per weighted student, and the reason I do this is because the weighted students adjusts in some sense for the costs of educating students. So in other words, if our weights are growing fast, if our added weights are growing faster than just our student population, that indicates that we're educating students who need more resources. The fall here is even larger. This is about 23% decline over that period.
I'm sorry, would you say that percentage number again? I missed it.
About 23.
23, thank you.
Yeah. I've got some slides here about the task force. Senator Devlin did a really nice job of summarizing what the task force did. I've got a slide here with the members, and but I did want to highlight a couple things. First one, the high-cost disability grant, you can see that started out funded at $12 million a year, and at that rate in 03-04, it was able to pay 71 cents on the dollar for districts' costs above $30,000 on an individual student. The law reads that if there's not enough to fully reimburse them, then it's prorated. So it was prorated down to 71 cents on the dollar. By 06-07, that had fallen to 60 cents, and so the legislature increased funding to $18 million a year, which bumped it back up to 76 cents on the dollar, but now we're down to 42 cents on the dollar for those costs. So those costs are rising, but the funding has not kept up with that. And then a little bit about limited English proficient students and English as a second language programs. this is a graph. Each bar here is an individual district, and this shows the percentage of the amount that the district got through its extra half weight through our formula that they actually spent or reported spending on their ESL program. And it ranges from over 200%, so more than twice as much as they got through the formula they spent on their ESL programs, down to below 20% for the low-funded ones. There's actually a handful down here that reported getting some money through the formula but didn't report any spending. So you see those blanks there at the right-hand end of this graph. About 10 years ago, the department did an analysis of these spending patterns and how they related to the academic outcomes of limited English proficient students. And we did find a correlation between the amount that districts spent on their programs and the outcomes they got for their students. So it appeared that those that spent more were getting better results for their ESL students.
Did you say that the blank at the end is related to districts with very small numbers, or is it something else?
Well, the ones down there are very small districts that they reported some ESL students, but they didn't report any spending. Now
they didn't have a special program for ESL.
Right.
If you only have 70 students in your district, you're not likely to have a special program.
Well, in order to get the funding, they are required to provide a program. And what we think is that the districts are not equipped to isolate those expenditures and separate them from their regular spending. If you only have one or two ASL students, you're unlikely to run a separate classroom for them. And so trying to divide up a teacher's time between those students and regular students is something the districts really have a hard time doing. We've been told that that's the case even in larger districts, that these numbers are imperfect, and so we need to keep that in mind when we do this kind of evaluation. And one of the recommendations of the task force is that we help the districts devise a better way to collect that data so it's more accurate.
Oh, yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to confirm, and I think this is correct, but of course ODE doesn't have any mechanisms to actually trace the extra weighting that goes to districts on a per student basis to ensure that the districts actually use those resources to benefit the students in whom it's targeted towards, i.e. ESL, ELL, or poverty. You know, so there will be, I think, some attempts to perhaps shine a little light on that this session, but again, the districts get the resource, but how they utilize that resource is completely up to them at the local level. So,
yeah, Representative Leininger.
Thanks. Is there any weight for talented and gifted programs?
I see six more reports.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Leininger, no, there's not. We do have data on how much districts spend on those programs, but there is no weight for those students.
There is a carve-out,
yes,
at the beginning.
Smith,
well, correct, but it's a relatively small amount. It's not allocated out to districts based on the number of students in those programs, as far as I know. But there's no explicit weight in the formula itself.
Representative Vega Peterson?
No.
Did you have something else, Representative Leininger?
And just one final graph here, again related to limited English proficient students. This is some work that my staff and I have been doing over the last year or so. And looking at, now that we have a really good history of student level data, what we did was follow a cohort of students who were identified as limited English proficient in fifth grade back in 2003-04. And then followed them through high school to see what their high school outcomes were. And the interesting thing to me about this is if you look in the first two columns, the one that's labeled exited before high school, those are students who exited LEP status before they reached high school. In other words, they were considered proficient in English before they reached high school and look at their graduation rate, 75.8%, which is actually higher than the statewide average graduation rate. So their dropout rate was 11%, also relatively good compared to the statewide average for all students.
Just so we're certain that we understand the slide, could you tell us what LEP stands for?
Limited English Proficient.
Thank you.
We've got three or four different terms that we use for students whose first language isn't English, and some of them are interchangeable and some of them are not.
Right.
And
you've done very extremely well during this presentation on this issue, but it would be, I think, the public and the committee would benefit from having acronyms like this spelled out.
Yeah, I think the two most common terms for students who are still not fluent in English is limited English proficient or English language learners, ELL. The term ESL is specific to English as a second language programs, so it's a programmatic definition, not a student level descriptor.
Okay.
So if you look at the second two columns, these are students who had not exited when they entered high school, but they exited during high school. So they were considered proficient in English at some point before they left the K-12 system. And you can see that their graduation rate is a bit lower than those who did exit before high school, but still relatively high, 66.7%. And their dropout rate is not dramatically high. But the third two columns are the ones that are really striking, is that if a student gets all the way through high school and does not exit LEP status, their graduation rate is down to 52% and their dropout rate soars to 27%. So this really is behind some of the push that we've seen recently to try to devote more resources to these students and to get them proficient earlier, because what this suggests is that the earlier that they get proficient in English, the much higher their chances are of successfully graduating from high school. So I think, you know, behind Deputy Superintendent Saxton's proposal to raise the weight slightly and to provide some incentives, Representative Johnson talked about this earlier, about providing some incentives within our formula that are based on outcomes, the 4 and 7 year scheme that Deputy Superintendent Saxton proposed is one of those things. It's an incentive to encourage districts to exit those kids as quickly as they can. Right now, you get the extra half weight as long as the student is identified, and we see kids who are in LEP status for 12 years, and those are the kids who are not graduating. They're dropping out at much higher rates, and so that's what his proposal was designed to do, is both a little extra resource and some incentives to get those kids proficient as quickly as possible. And there's a lot of research that shows that really has big benefits down the road for them. So I'm going to stop with that, and if there are more questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Questions, comments? Representative Smith-Horner.
Could I just go back briefly, a question that I meant to ask when you were talking about cost drivers.
Mm-hmm.
So just a little bit part of yours. Now, of course, this won't page back up to me. There we go. Can you talk about, and you may not have the information now, how like those cost drivers, how we compared other states in the increase in cost drivers, like salary, benefits, et cetera?
Well, the salary and benefits one is easy. It's really not about salary at all. It's about benefits, and it's about our retirement system. if you compare Oregon to Washington, Washington's mm-hmm. employer contribution a few years ago, I haven't checked recently, was 2%. Ours is in the 20s. Or in here it's 18.55. I think it jumped up from here and then it's come back down a little bit. But the PERS system, not sure the most delicate way to put it, but it got out of control. So we've got massive costs in our retirement system, and the part that's probably the most unfortunate is the reason these rates are so high. A big chunk of that money is going to people who have already retired. So we're paying costs now that are not accruing to mm-hmm. to people in the system, to people who are still working right now. So we're not paying that much to teachers, our current teachers. We're paying them those salaries, but their benefits down the road from the retirement system are much lower than folks who are currently retired or who will soon retire. And these are dollars that don't make it to the classroom.
You know, it would be useful in partial answer to Representative Smith Warner's question, and this is probably directed to both you and to the staff here, is to figure out how we compare against other states when you regularize the or normalize the pension benefits. I mean, we all know a couple of things. One is that Oregon is among the highest funded pension plans in the country, almost always, as a percentage of the obligations that we owe. So we put more money in up front than other places do, and therefore we're less likely to hit a crisis point down the road when every penny of resources has to go into paying pensions because they didn't put money aside. The other thing we know is that Oregon had a couple of extremely serious errors committed by the PERS board in the late 90s. I mean, I think everybody knows that now. I don't think we knew, we certainly didn't know it then, or the legislature would have acted earlier than it did in 2003. But if we could figure out a way to regularize that error and to account for the fact that from the standpoint of the treasurer, we've done a great job of funding the pension fund that we have, then these numbers compared to the numbers from other states would be more meaningful if you could make those kinds of adjustments. Laura Lockwood McCall in the Treasurer's Office has tried to do that in the context of what she works with, but not in this context. And I think it'd be great to answer the representative's question, but I don't think you can do it without realizing that Oregon systems and the systems in other states are not comparable, and that while it looks like we're talking about the same thing when we talk about benefits, we're not, because we handle them differently. So that's just a suggestion to the people who handle figuring out how to do numbers.
Paul's smarter than I am, so he'll do it.
Yeah. Representative Leininger.
Well, you know, to build on that, I think the really interesting thing to assess is where we are now, like you said, is a really different place than where we were before. And so, you know, really what we should be looking at is the cost, you know, assuming going forward that we're now in this new OPSERP world, or maybe there's a post-OPSERP world, I'm not clear on that, but, you know, our costs going forward are informed by really substantial changes that have been implemented, you know, and if the court upholds them, we'll continue to be implemented. But, you know, it feels like we beat ourselves up about decisions that were made in the 90s by the PERS board, but a lot of things have changed since then, and I certainly hope that our public employees don't keep getting tarred and feathered for the fact that at some point decisions were made differently than they are now. But, you know, as we think about our growth rates and costs too, it would be helpful to look at it in that frame.
Yeah, thank you. And may I simply say, my intention in asking or in stating the issue that way was not to beat up on public employees,
no,
but
so.
Rather was to actually clarify how Oregon does its arithmetic differently than other states,
right,
so that we can actually make meaningful comparisons,
right,
which are not possible from the raw numbers.
I agree.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And these numbers are 012-13 numbers, and they're, since I wasn't on the subcommittee on the PERS grand bargain or anything like that, I'm doing this from memory, but can you share with me if my memory is right that if the court upholds the changes that were made, that 18.55% number will still be around 23%, and if the court doesn't uphold it, it'll be closer to 28. Is that correct? Am I remembering that right?
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Benz, my memory is probably not any better than yours, so I don't know those numbers for sure, but the swing based on the court decision, I think, is about in that ballpark, four points.
Right, 4.5-ish.
Yeah.
So follow up.
Yes, sure. Please.
So what I'm saying is that number is dramatically understated from what it really is today, even with the good work done in the grand bargain. I've had much occasion to compare Oregon's current system to nationwide systems, and it's an interesting exercise because so many states apparently thought someone would come along and bail them out.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty low bar, was what I'm really saying, Mr. Chair.
Oh, yes, I agree.
And so I'm not sure how much good it does to compare ourselves to others who've done far worse at taking care of their public employees, but it does seem to me that the real issue is how much of our current dollar is going toward this particular need and how much we don't have left. And that's a far more meaningful exercise. That's why I ask, isn't that really 23-24% even after the change? And if it isn't, boy, is it really bad? Because that kind of thing would be helpful for me. So if you could obtain that would be great.
I think for planning purposes, that would be wonderful. Representative Johnson.
Well, and to answer Representative Bence's question, is the number is higher than this because this 18.55 doesn't include the site accounts that many districts have because they bonded a considerable amount of their PERS obligation. I.e., I'll just my own example in Hood River County, where we went from about, I mean, our current rate, I think, is somewhere north of 26-27%, and this is after the reforms that we passed in the special session, where it knocked about 4.5% off. So most districts are well above this. It just depends on how much of that bonded site account that they still have to retire as well. So this doesn't tell the full story.
Thank you. To put that in the form of a question, is that number, those site account payments, embedded in this someplace, or is it a different number?
Chair Barnhart, this is the actual rate, and the way I look at site accounts.
Oh, it's a different number.
Correct.
Yeah, the way I tend to look at the site accounts is a separate source of revenue for the district. So
it's expenditures is what it is.
Well, right, but if I'm a district that has a site account and therefore I can, you know, on net I can buy my PERS rate down to 10% instead of this 18.5. It's the 18.55 that flows into the system. They just use some of their side account earnings to pay that part of that amount. And so you have a look on your face that says I'm confusing.
Well, I'm confused because confusing. Of course there aren't any earnings here. What we're talking about is buying down an obligation with bond money that you then have to pay off. Where you make money on it, if you do, only in theory, of course, is the difference between the interest rate on the bonds and what you would otherwise have to pay into the PERS account if you were to pay it later. And the question then is, did you guess right when you decided that when to buy the bonds? I mean, when to sell the bonds? Sorry, to sell the bonds.
That's correct, and Chair Barnhart, that's sort of what I mean by a revenue source is if your earnings on, I mean the when you sell bonds, those are invested by the Oregon Investment Board, like all other PERS monies, and if the earnings on that are above what you're paying for
on the bond.
Your interest rate on your bonds, those revenue are then used to buy down your PERS rate, in essence.
Correct.
To prepay.
Thank you. Now and I understand what you mean by revenue. I've never thought of that as revenue, but I get it now.
But, you know, we hear districts say, well, my PERS rate is jumping. You know, my PERS rate right now, my net rate is 8%, and it's going to go up from 8 to 15. and that's a huge percentage increase. That's almost a doubling. But districts who didn't bond are going from 18 or 20 up to 24 or 25. And so, you had a larger percentage increase if you had a site account, but in sheer dollar amounts, you're still better off than those districts who don't have site accounts that are earning money for them.
If you sold bonds on the correct
at the right time, yes.
Yeah. Representative Johnson, did you have anything else?
Site conversations.
Oh, no. Okay. All right. members, we are out of time for today. We're supposed to adjourn at 2:45, and it's 2:46. I think we can we excuse him now? And thank you very much. We really appreciate this excellent presentation. I wish we had a lot more time to go into all the nuances, but we don't. Colleagues, we're going to hold over the discussion of transportation until next Thursday. We'll repost for Thursday of next week, because something that we had originally planned for Thursday is not going to happen, and we'll have some other things for Thursday. All right?
Yeah.
And we'll see you on Monday. With that, the committee is adjourned.
Special episode.